Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
The show may sound a little bit different today as we are all recording remotely, so bear with us for the next few weeks, or maybe even months. We also want to hear directly from you, the listeners. What are you reading while self-isolating around the world? Let us know by dropping us an email at books.podcast@theguardian.com. We know there's a world of readers out there, and we'll aim to reflect it by featuring your suggestions. This week, we return to life before lockdown in a discussion with Toby Ferris about his pursuit of the Dutch master Pieter Bruegel. But we'll focus on the current moment later in the show, when we talk to bookseller Sam Fisher and Hay Festival director Peter Florence about the resourceful ways people in the literary world are dealing with the fallout from the pandemic. Toby Ferris was 42 when he decided he would track down the 42 surviving paintings by the 16th century Dutch master Pieter Bruegel. Bruegel is famous for the brimming humanity of rustic paintings like The Fall of Icarus. You probably know it, even if it doesn't come immediately to mind. It's the picture with Icarus's legs disappearing into a bright green sea in the background, while in the foreground, a ploughman and his horse go about their business. As Ferris travelled between London and Vienna, Darmstadt and Detroit, he found himself face to face with questions of art, fatherhood, and mortality. When he came to the studio, Richard began by asking him how he came up with his plan to confront the singular images Bruegel has left behind.
I was working on a website called Anatomy of Norbotten, which was about Renaissance, Italian Renaissance art, and it started to drift into Netherlandish art. And at a certain point, in about 2012, I found myself looking at a Bruegel image and thinking, oh, that's Bruegel. I think I know some other Bruegel. And looking at the Wikipedia page and just being struck by how many of them were these sort of iconic, such well-known paintings, but not, I hadn't really associated them together with this one figure. So I was sort of struck by that, and at the same time, I think it felt a little bit like I'd found the code of the cosmos, if you like. It sounds very, very grand, but what I mean by that is it suddenly you see connections between things. I hadn't really understood that the sons had spent so much time copying their father's work over and over and over again. So when I saw Bruegel's in museums, you know, in Cambridge, for example, where I live, there are three, but they're Pieter Bruegel the younger, his son.
The other Bruegel.
Yeah, so I thought, well, you know, what's... And then I think the first Bruegel that I really sort of saw in a museum and that really affected me was the census at Bethlehem. And that hangs in the museum in Brussels. And on the adjacent wall, there's a copy by his son, and it's almost identical. And that threw me. And so I realised, you know, okay, there's good Bruegel, there's bad Bruegel, you know, so I'll look at the good Bruegel. But you can't detach them that. And he's a very good copyist, the son. And he also copied paintings that we no longer have. There are examples of copies that, you know, clearly model on his father's work, but we don't have the original anymore. So it's a huge, you know, documentary terms, it's hugely important as well.
You talk about a vast singular object that spans the world, this Bruegel object, a fascinating way of thinking about this oeuvre.
Yeah. I mean, if you kind of bash them all together, I think I spent quite a lot of time working out the, you know, what the total area of this thing would
be. The surface area, the thing.
They seem to belong together in a way that paintings by other artists, which of course belong, you know, Titian, for example, they belong together, but Bruegel's could almost be this one space, almost, you know, take a couple out, that sort of copious world, village world, they have a sense of, I always think of Richard Scarry. Have you ever read Richard Scarry?
The busy, busy world.
Busy, busy world, yeah. And, you know, a busy town. So that, and you have these little tiny vignettes all over the place that you have to... And Bruegel, there's a sort of continuum. It's like turning the page of a Richard Scarry in a way. All these kind of very familiar and slightly peculiar objects in the world. So, you know, it's like in Richard Scarry, you get the gherkin lorries driven by a pig eating a gherkin, and it's in the shape of a gherkin, and there are gherkins flying out the back. That's not a million miles away from Bruegel. I think that probably, at the time this project, I started thinking about this project, 2012, my children were at Richard Scarry kind of age. I think I was spending a lot of time reading, you know, Busy, Busy World and all that stuff.
Yeah, because, I mean, the Bruegel object is now distributed in space with his paintings dispersed around the world, uh-huh. You know, between Vienna, London, Darmstadt, Detroit. But it's also distributed in time. Mm. You're seeing his work as you go around. You're seeing his work in patchwork fashion. Mm. So is that kind of Richard Scarry element? Is that one of the things that comes through?
I hadn't considered that, the sort of page-turning element of going through the work. But it was curious because the first thing I did in 2012 when I realised, God, you know, this is just great. I really want to get to know this stuff. And I bought a huge, absolutely enormous book by a very eminent Bruegel scholar called Larry Silver. It's an enormous book of brilliant reproductions. And I started going through this book. And I looked at them all. I got to know them all very well. And then I started traveling around to see them. But I sort of, by the time I got to the end, the last one I saw, in brackets, actually it wasn't quite the last one, we can talk about that as well if you like, but the last one I saw was the end of the last journey was the Hay Harvest, which is in Prague, and it was one that I hadn't really thought about at all to the point where I went to see it. It's on its own in a room in the Lobkowitz Palace in Prague, and I went in there and I sat and looked at it for an hour, and it was extraordinary, and the sense of discovering it was almost as if it was the first time I'd seen it, that sense of freshness and just examining the detail for the first time.
I was struck by your suggestion that the mad behaviour of the people in his proverb paintings would start to look a bit less crazy, a bit more human, with the addition of a bit of context. I'm wondering if Bruegel's working in a kind of pre-Shakespearean world where the characters are kind of stock characters with no inner life, where they're just merely the butt of a joke.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think you're absolutely right to connect it with Shakespeare, connect it the other direction with Rabelais, this very theatrical world. In fact, that sense that he lived in a world that expressed itself also in Antwerp in 1550, 1560, that expressed itself in the popular theatre, and they would have theatrical competitions between local villages and so on. And he obviously was bound up in that, and that was how he thought to some degree, and also the proverbs connect with that, as you say. But at the same time, he's clearly a painter who absolutely gets people, or I guess outsiders largely, but people in general, on their own terms. So, and the best example of that is the children, that you get a sense with Bruegel that he absolutely just got them on their own terms in a way that's quite modern, that you don't associate with other artists of that time.
You talk about painting as a medium of exchange, imagining as you stand in front of his paintings that you and Bruegel are standing in a market hoping to strike a good bargain at a fair price and each go home happy. But I was wondering, what's in it for Bruegel? I mean, he's been dead for 450 years.
Yeah, well, I think it's probably one of the dangers of writing about this stuff or thinking about this stuff is that you get seduced into looking for points of contact. It's a way of appropriating him to my world, in a sense, because I have, you know,
it almost feels like you get to know him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We can understand each other, look each other in the eye. I'm not sure that's entirely true. So he lives in a world that, in so many ways, is utterly alien. That just the way that they think about how the world is full of similarities all the way down the scale, from, you know, the microcosmic to the macrocosmic. And you cut a walnut and it looks like a brain, and therefore it's good. And all these similarities that the world is a book you can read. All of this stuff is utterly alien in a way. And worry about the fact that any art or any music or whatever it is you engage with, in a sense, you're imposing yourself on it. And again, I think I say this somewhere in the book, that I'm not really in this room to learn something about Bruegel. I'm here to impose my own patterns. And you have to think that any project like mine, and I suppose any book, or any, you know, it has a sort of neurosis at its centre. It might be quite benign or, you know, small scale. I think it was in my case. But I'm conscious of the fact that the Bruegel thing emerged for me at a time where I was undergoing a pretty rapid change of identity from being a sort of feckless, you know, kid who just, you know, went spent my time in Europe and, you know, teaching and not really looking, you know, building a career or anything, to suddenly my father's dead, I've got two children, my mother's got dementia, and I'm somehow I'm the father figure in my own world. And that was a pretty rapid change, as it is for many people. And at that exact time, I was imposing this pattern on it. That might just be coincidence, but it's happened before.
Yeah, standing in front of Dulla Greet, you lament the lack of a vocabulary for visual perception. So that standing there is a kind of noteworthy percept of ruddiness, as you say. But isn't that kind of the point of visual art, that you can produce visual sensations that, yeah, are kind of worth noticing?
Absolutely so. I think that what struck me about the Dulla Greet, in fact, was that it was like standing in front of a Rothko. You know, that colour field that somehow sets up this strange perceptual harmonic in you, and, you know, that you respond to in a very visceral kind of way. All the way through the book, I'm kind of worried about how you read a painting and then how you experience it when you stand in front of it. It's a rather different thing. There's a great book by, a very famous book by T.J. Clarke, The Sight of Death, where he, you know, T.J. Clarke, an art historian, who goes every day to see these same two Poussin paintings and writes about how the light changes in a very detailed way, about how, you know, how his experience, what he notices that particular day, like diary entries effectively. And then at the end, there's a penny dropping moment where it turns out that, of course, he's thinking about his mother and mortality and all sorts of stuff that was bound up that you hadn't realised was there. But that sense that the way that you experience a painting is rather different from the way you then talk about it, or write about it, of course, and that trying to capture that, which the book a little bit does, is tricky.
Well, necessarily tricky, because otherwise they might have, you know, written something down rather than bothered with the brushes.
Yeah, well, that's also true, yeah, absolutely true, that it's its own world, its own language world, yeah.
I mean, you'd say that Bruegel's peasants are living up on the surface of the world, locked into everlasting cycles, they're fully alive. I wonder if you're in danger of romanticising their actually quite awkward, brutal lives.
Yeah, I think, as I said before, that I think you impose something that you want to see. And so if I'm looking for a solution to some sort of, you know, psycho-spiritual sort of crisis, a midlife crisis, if that's what I'm looking for, that kind of solution, then of course I'm going to make things sit in a pattern that is congenial to me. You know, that's why I'm here. And so you're right. And what you hope, of course, is that you can't quite do that, and that things spill out of the edges a bit. I was conscious writing about, you know, for example, the beggars, a small painting in Paris, and there are also the same group of beggars in Carnival in Lent, which is in Vienna. And it's obviously something that, and they're lepers. They have, you know, various disfigurements. They've lost legs and so on. They have prostheses, these wooden prostheses. And I was conscious writing about that what you want to see is a painter, Bruegel, who has this great human, I don't know, generalizing, romanticizing horribly, spirit, who looks at these marginal outcast individuals and feels this great sort of, you know, in his terms, Christ-like, you know, sense, you know, sense of their ostracization. So I don't know that that's true. I think Bruegel was very capable of creating patterns from some of these outsider groups that are, we would find inimical. So he, for example, gypsies is another good example. And gypsy is kind of the correct word in this case, because people outside the gypsy community impose on gypsies. And he uses them as a sign of some kind of menace, or some kind of, you know, some. So in the census of Bethlehem, there's a gypsy woman with these very characteristic round hats stealing vegetables from the garden of a leper who's got his little leper hut in his little garden there.
That's the stereotypical image of...
Yeah, sort of marauding outsiders. You can't, you know. And so he's quite capable of that. And you wonder how hard his eye was and how, you know, accurate in that sense, but also how he would have thought it was peculiar to bond all these people together in a sense of, you know, these are outsiders and marginal people. Like, you know, you sort of identify with that in some way. It's a complex thing, I think. It's a complex reaction that you have to, and, you know, There's no simple answer, but I think you're right. There is a danger of romanticising.
I mean, you say that it's a complex situation and there's no simple answer, but he keeps sliding out of your grasp, doesn't he? I mean, there's the small roundel of the drunkard pushed into the pigsty, the singularity, as you write, of, at the heart of your project. And what about the panels which may or may not be by Bruegel, or his drawings, or his engravings? I mean, it seems so graspable, but it's actually totally unfinishable.
Well, yes and no. So I drew a line at the graphic work, so the drawings and the engravings, just because they're wonderful, and I do talk about them a bit in the book, but they're often in private collections and or collections to which it's difficult to gain access if you're not an art historian. I try to see some in the Albertina, the drawing museum in Vienna, but they said no, come back and we've got an exhibition in a year, come back and look at them then. So that's fine, fair enough. But so I drew a line there, but the Bruegel catalogue is in fact extremely stable and extremely well documented, partly because he did it himself. Almost every painting is carefully signed and dated. And attribution, you're right, that around the margins there are some that might or might not be by him, but very few. If you compare it with Bosch, for example, or Holbein, where they're a school of or workshop of, or attribution is discussed endlessly. It just isn't the case with Bruegel. You get a sense that it's quite a tight thing. So of course I made arbitrary, I put arbitrary boundaries around it, but there's only really a small handful that...
But there's a little blurring, a fading, nevertheless. You speak about standing in front of the hay harvest in Prague. You ask when you'll be done with looking, and I guess, again, isn't that kind of the point of art, or at least art that's any good, is that you're never quite done with looking?
Yeah, I think that's part of how it got hitched into a project, in a sense. And as I say, that's not the first time I'd done that. The website that I still work on intermittently, Anatomy of Norbiton, about Renaissance Italian art mainly, is this ongoing, unending, because it's already got up to the letter T. It's alphabetized, and I think I'm about to do a page in U for the first time. So it's this non-ending kind of thing, but it's a way of trying to grapple them into some meaningful structure. And a book is a finished object. A book is, I mean, like it or not, at some point you deliver the manuscript. You, in a way, the book is a way of yoking all that experience together and making it, giving it a certain shape.
But maybe that's kind of the part of the problem of a project like this, of a book like this anyway, that it necessarily ignores some of the messiness of the world around it.
Yeah, I don't know that writing is necessarily tidy and art is necessarily messy in that respect. I think good writing, if you engage properly with something, can also have these messy fractal edges. And so that, I say it's a contained book, but then a painting is contained within its frame and whatever it is. So perhaps, you hope that you capture something of irreconcilables in between the experience and the what you know about the painting, or between different paintings, or between readings of paintings, that something of that will inevitably creep into a book. A book, I'm struck, is quite a big thing. So it is bigger than you realise when you have to grapple with every single detail. So maybe it does kind of come towards a point of contact in that sense with the art and the sprawliness of the art.
Now, you say that it came out of some sort of midlife crisis in a way. I mean, Bruegel himself died at 42, producing paintings for 17 years between about 1552 and 1569. Does that kind of productivity, does that kind of brief career of amazingness make you feel a little bit like you're living on borrowed time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm 50 now. And, I've just sort of plopped out one book and there it is. Now I think, well, maybe I've got another one maybe on the go, but oh God, time is so short. Yeah, definitely. And I think that I was working on stuff before, and I had the website. I also wrote books that, novels I couldn't get published in my 20s, that kind of stuff. So I have been working on it for a while, but he was working on paintings for even less time than that. It was about 9 years, because his graphic art started in the 1550s. He didn't really the first attested art panel is 1557. Then there's a 2 year gap, 1559. So it's about 8 or 9 years, and an extraordinary assurance that he had working in paint at that point. But he was I'm not sure I want to compare myself with Bruegel or what, worry that I'm not as somehow as, you know, productive or, you know.
I guess maybe you resist comparing yourself to Bruegel, but I mean, I wonder if this book is in some sense also an answer to that empty diary of your father's as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I think the story is my father decided to write his memoir. This is in 1979, which incidentally was a year after his father died. And that was a peculiar relationship, which I never really fathomed. But he sat down, he decided to write his memoir, and he wrote one line, which was something like, "It is said that in every life there's one book, and this is mine," some cliche sort of opening. And he would have had a couple of whiskies and sat down and done this, and this huge desk diary, absolutely enormous thing. And that was it. And then it was on the shelf in our house for years. I still have it. The sense that he was, a man of blank pages. And I don't mean by that he didn't have lived experience. Of course he did, but I know very little about it. And my brother and I have talked about this, the sense that it's also generational, I suppose, not just personal, but that he wasn't someone that talked about, you know, except in the most anecdotal, if he had a few favourite anecdotes, he got drunk, he'd have a few whiskies and the same anecdotes would come out. But that sense that life for him never really quite, you know, coalesced and, you know, in the way that it could have done, or he would like it to have done. And I think this is definitely a response to that in some way. It has to be, you know, that's why he finds his way into the book so much. You know, inevitably he's there. He pops up here and there, and it's clearly on my mind that this is something I'm dealing with, and part of the whole, you know, there's also the character of Dan as a character, as a person, but he's in the book, I suppose, a character. Dan died at the age of, in his early 20s, and the book starts with this paragliding accident that Dan was involved in, and he survived that, but then a couple of years later he died. And he was the most vital person I've ever met. He was extraordinary. I climbed a mountain with him one time. Climbed a mountain sounds grand. I walked up a mountain, it happened to be an Aran, walked up Goat Fell, and when we were resting and breathing hard, he was walking around on his hands, not even particularly showing off. He just couldn't stop. He was like one of those kids that, you know, just never ever stops. And so the contrast between that concentration of life and then my dad's vast empty book, that I guess, you know, there's stuff there. That's clearly something you want to, at a certain point in your life, you start to worry about, you know, just, you know, get angsty about whatever it is, you know. So yeah, I'm sure that's
in there too. I mean, yeah. This book, this glossy publication with the full bleed images, the glowing reviews, the appearance on the Guardian Books podcast, is this the final failure in a life of failure attempted with superior clarity and precision in Normanton?
That's interesting. I don't know. I don't know how familiar you are with the Norberton site. The Norberton site has a narratorial voice, right? And so he was slightly crazy, and someone once said to me, "It's batshit crazy. This guy is batshit crazy." And so that's fine. And so I handle stuff that he essentially has a very systemizing kind of brain and a very unemotional response. But he likes art, so he writes about art a lot. Slightly odd kind of way. And when I wrote the book, I was obviously, that wasn't what I was going for. Batshit crazy was not the desire.
Different mood.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. But I don't know. You see, I don't know how much, and I've started to think about this quite a lot recently, how much A is not in the book. I'm sure there is an element of that, because I talk about the spreadsheet that I drew up, but I really did draw up a spreadsheet. So maybe the narratorial voice, as I like to call it, there's a little bit of truth in that as well. So there is a lot of overlap. I think there's definitely a continuum between Norberton and Bruegel. Some of the passages in the Bruegel book actually originally were in Norberton. I just extracted them and used them in the book because they were the right kind of, you know, because they were my responses to the paintings I was seeing at the time. So there's
part of the similar project, or the same project in some sort of different way.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was Toby Ferris. Short Life in a Strange World is published by Fourth Estate in the UK and Harper in the US. After the break, we'll be talking to Sam Fisher from London independent bookshop Burley Fisher about how coronavirus is affecting book sales, and to Peter Florence about how the Hay Festival is coping with life under lockdown. But before we get to that, we'd love to get your views regarding the wider world of podcasts. Your opinions will be extremely valuable to us and will be used to help shape the future of Guardian Podcasts. As a thank you for your contribution, there will be a chance for you to win a John Lewis voucher worth £250. Don't worry, we will not take any personal details other than an email address if you'd like to be entered into the prize draw. If you'd like to help us with this, you can access the survey on guardiansurveys.com/podcast, or alternatively, click on the link to the survey in the notes for this episode.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to the Guardian Books podcast. Coronavirus has meant that some of us have a bit more free time for leisure activities, like reading. We are really interested to find out what you are reading right now. On our tips, links and suggestions blog, some of our readers have been telling us about how self-isolation has changed what they're reading. One regular, Pat Lux, said they have been revisiting books that they had bought in art galleries around the world. They wrote, "I tend to look at them on the journey home, and then they sit on my shelves for years. I have decided that each day I will remove one book from my shelves and leaf through it. This will doubtless bring to mind memories of not only the paintings, but also the trip to the city where the art gallery is."
Yeah, I'm with Pat Lux on this one. I recently went all the way to Guatemala. Can you imagine those days? To interview an amazing Swiss-Argentinian eco-artist, that's what I think of her as anyway, called Vivian Suter. And I have a great fat catalogue on my coffee table of the amazing work she's done in her garden, where it looks much more alive than it does in the sort of grey English light of Camden Art Centre, where she's just recently been exhibiting. And I do actually look at it again and again, and it makes me feel happy, and it makes me feel as if I'm outside.
And I mean, there is, I guess, like, there's nothing like a crisis to make us appreciate books that we already have, but it's interesting to see how it might be affecting our appetite for buying new books. And bookshops are not on the list for essential retailers that have been allowed to stay open in the UK. But a couple of weeks ago, we reported on the ingenious lengths that some booksellers were going to get books to their customers, using skateboards and bicycles and delivering them by hand. And last week, we reported that book sales in the UK have been skyrocketing in the lead up to the lockdown. And on the line with us now is Sam Fisher from the London bookshop Burley Fisher Books to tell us about how it's all going. Hi, Sam.
Hi there. How's it going?
Oh, really well, thank you. How are you going? Because you've been out delivering books on your bike.
Well, up until last Monday, we were out on our bikes. We were doing it for about a week from when people started self-isolating as a way to try and make sure people could still get their books.
But then that all changed. Did that all change when Boris made his announcement, Boris Johnson made his announcement about the lockdown?
It did, yeah. We decided, in order to kind of reduce the amount of contact, we would only deliver books by post, since the postal workers are going out anyway. It seemed to make sense that we would use that service rather than kind of increasing the amount of contact by going out on our bike.
How was it when you were delivering it by hand? What? Because obviously you were then seeing customers at that point yourselves. Was there a lot of enthusiasm for what you guys were doing?
Yeah, there was a huge amount of enthusiasm, which we were really grateful for, because we were obviously really worried about what the uncertainty was going to mean for the shop. But the way that the community responded was incredibly reassuring. And it was really interesting to go and speak to people on their doorsteps, which is it's a kind of slightly different scenario to our usual day-to-day.
And so now you're sending out books. I mean, There's some numbers that we reported last week that included that overall book sales in the UK were up 6%, but paperback fiction had shot up by 38%, and nonfiction was down 13%. Have you noticed any trends in what people are buying at the moment?
I think definitely fiction has seen a huge spike. People are looking for escape from their confinement in the stories of that other people have written. So I think long books as well. There was kind of initially a slight spike in books about plague, Journal of the Plague Year and Station 11 and other plague narratives, which was, but that seems to have tailed off slightly now that people realise that they're stuck inside for the foreseeable, I think, perhaps don't want to read about the plague quite so much.
I think it's fair enough.
We think about the books going out to customers, but what about the supply line to you? Are you having problem getting books into the bookshop?
Well, the it depends. But a lot of the couriers are having trouble because I think of their slightly shady employment practices, meaning that it's difficult for them to get workers in when workers get ill. But the Royal Mail is still working so far really, really well. So, yeah. It's more a case of making because we're working unusual hours is that can be difficult, yeah.
And what is the mood among the staff? Like, how are you guys all feeling at this point in time about the future of the shop?
I think at this point we still feel positive. It's strange having to work remotely. Obviously, it's a business that you normally see each other all the time. So we actually started a podcast as well as a way of kind of to try and keep us connected with one another. So that's been a great way of kind of keeping the spirit up. But yeah, I mean, it's been very busy. So at the moment, I still feel fairly positive about the future of the bookshop and the enthusiasm for the written word.
Yeah, that has been one sort of remarkable thing to see that I think there's this pressure on people at the moment to use their time in some sort of useful way and somehow better themselves by writing screenplays and reading challenging books. But it's actually been remarkable to see that so many people are up for that challenge and they are going out and buying War and Peace and sort of trickier books that perhaps they wouldn't have normally had the time for. So thank you so much, Sam.
No pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So that's some good news. But the coronavirus is also hitting cultural events and festivals hard. One of them is the Hay Literature Festival, which sees more than 250,000 people head to the tiny town in Wales each year in May and June. Recently, the coronavirus meant the 2020 festival had to be cancelled. But with 70% of its finances coming from ticket and book sales, the entire future of the festival is now in doubt. Here to tell us a bit more about it is the director, Peter Florence. Peter, welcome. How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling amazingly encouraged by the extraordinary response we've had over the last 10 days from the public, from writers, from our colleagues and partners about how we might move forward together. Obviously, you're right. It's a devastating blow for us, but it's also really hard for all the freelancers who speak on our stages, for all the local services that depend on the festival. You know, the festival runs for 11 days, but is responsible for generating about £26 million every year into the local economy, and that's all gone in a flash. The problem for us was largely one of timing. It came at the absolute maximum point of exposure, where we'd spent vast amounts of money on infrastructure and programming and planning, and it turns out that the end of May is going to be the peak of this horrific epidemic, and so inevitably, our first call was to try and make sure that everyone who lives in Hay, who is vulnerable, was protected and was not exposed.
So one thing I always say to people who people know about the Hay Festival, but unless you've actually been there and you've been there in festival time and also outside festival time, what is the amazing thing about this festival is most of the year it is just a field with cows in it. So this sort of huge thing grows up and generates a huge amount of money for the local economy from what is actually just a bit of pasture.
the spirit within the town is absolutely extraordinary. You suddenly get a very clear understanding of what an essential service actually is. And the way in which collaborations have been formed between the food retailers and the people who are working on the front line of care delivery is deeply moving. So the festival has its constituency here, but it also has a kind of global community of people who have responded so brilliantly to our call out. We had a GoFundMe campaign running that has had almost 2,000 people contributing to it.
You've asked for £150,000. You're about halfway there now, are you?
We're slightly further than that because we've also had a lot of people who had bought tickets who are being refunded. A lot of them have donated their ticket purchase in a separate account. So actually, we are getting close to it. We're still a little way to go. But the moving thing about it is that some of the people who are giving have been to the festival every year for the last 33 years. Some have grown up here. One who donated said he was actually conceived at the festival. There are a bunch of people who've never been who say, I'd like it to be there in the future, which is incredibly moving. And that's an amazing obligation that we have as an organization to meet up to that amazing generosity and commitment that people are showing.
So you have expanded internationally over the years, and you have, I think, is it 8 festivals now? And I noticed that on your website that you Croatia, which is only, it actually overlaps with the Welsh festival slightly, is still going ahead according to your website. Are you hoping to keep the international offering going?
We're about to announce the postponement of Croatia. We're looking at the moment at Mexico and Segovia in September and Peru in November and then Cartagena in January. But one of the wonderful things that has happened is we're all now talking and sharing best practice in what a digital festival might look like.
You already have your Hay levels, which suddenly struck me would be incredibly useful for some of the school students who found themselves at home bored. Just very quickly, say a little bit about what they are.
Oh, the Hay levels are a magic idea that were born out of the fact that Marcus de Sotoy was at school, I think, or university with the former head of Hereford Sixth Form College, who arranged to pick him up to bring him to the festival for his gig about 4 or 5 years ago. And Jonathan Godfrey, the teacher, picked Marcus up in a minivan in which he had 8 of his students who were coming to the gig. Marcus gave them an impromptu masterclass in the back of the minibus. And then we thought, how do we replicate that for pupils who don't happen to be in the back of that minibus? And Marcus and over 600 other academics from every discipline have recorded little 3-minute films from every subject, from history and economics and social sciences to math, physics, chemistry, biology, geography, history, and they're talking about A-level and GCSE syllabus work, and they're beautiful little nuggets of 3-minute superstardom and insight that don't necessarily teach you the syllabus but give you that added magic that might inspire young people to read on or think on about what they're talking about. A great resource and easily findable on YouTube, and the Hay levels name is quite cute and easily recognizable.
Peter, thank you. And that's all for this week. Next week we'll be talking to Greg Jenner about our obsession with celebrities. Don't forget to let us know what you're reading right now and how you're enjoying it. Drop us an email at books.podcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
And our producer, Esther Opoku-Jenny. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.